Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Some good cheer on pensions. Why, you might be able to retire earlier than you thought. Is it time to take profits on shares? Why, private investors seem to think so. And how much has your house price gone up? We look back at the last month and the last decade. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent. I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Alice Ross.
Hello.
Tanya Poley.
Hi.
And our special studio guest, Mark Baker of Capita Registrars.
Hello there.
So let's start with the money news. This week there was some rare but much needed festive cheer for investors in company pensions. New research from Mercer has found that many employees may be able to work fewer years than recently feared and still retire on a reasonable income thanks to the strong stock market rally this year. By comparing stock market conditions and annuity price movements at the end of October 2009 with those at the end of December 2008, Mercer's new pension barometer shows that a member of a defined contribution or DC scheme will now have to work around 6 months less in order to retire on the same expected income. So, Alice, after all the bad news about pension deficits and delayed retirement, this is a very welcome change in fortunes, isn't it?
It is a welcome change in fortunes. All of the news this time last year, and in fact earlier this year, was the doom and gloom. We kept hearing about people delaying their retirement, some people being forced to only retire part-time and continue working part-time. And those who were forced to retire because they didn't have the option of working longer were retiring on a much lower income for life, which was really affecting their quality of life in retirement. So it was a big problem this time last year. So this is great news. It's the combination of the rise in the stock market. Obviously, it's gone up quite considerably this year. And that means that people's pension pots are a bit larger. But then we've also seen annuity rates doing a bit better at the moment. So that means that they can buy a better level of income with the pot that they have. So you have this kind of double effect going on.
So what's the net effect then on when you can retire? Some people were looking at age 67, which is not when they would have been planning to stop working. Does it get a lot better because of this stock market rise?
It does. I mean, at the very worst point in all of this, which was probably March when the stock market was at its complete low of, what was it, 3,500 and something, and now it's, you know, well over 5,000. At that point, if you had been planning to retire at 65, you were probably looking at nearer 67 to have the same level of income. Now, what Mercer has calculated is that you could reach your target income at about 64 and a half. So it's looking a lot better than it was.
And I suppose we need to be clear that this is affecting people in defined contribution schemes. These are the schemes where you put your money in and how much you get just depends on how the investments fare. Whereas those few people who are still in defined benefit schemes, they haven't got to worry at all because they're going to retire at the age that they always plan to.
Yes, I mean, those who don't have to worry at all are probably those nearer to the retirement age of their scheme in the defined benefit schemes. I think there are definite concerns over anyone a bit younger, say in their 30s or 40s, who's in a DB scheme, because there are a lot of question marks over whether these schemes are going to stay open because they just provide too generous benefits in retirement to really be sustainable. But the DC schemes, which are more popular now, they basically pass the risk on to the employee, and so you're kind of at the mercy of stock markets and annuity rates when you retire, so it's more difficult to predict. But it also means that it's harder for employers to know when their employees are going to retire, so this could be difficult for smaller businesses.
I suppose that it means that there are almost two sets of would-be retirees, those who know exactly when they're going to go, they're probably going to be at age 65, and those in these defined contribution schemes who are going to have to, I suppose, constantly look at the clock or Mercer's pensions barometer in order to get a feel for whether it's going to be 65, 64, 67.
Exactly, yeah. You really have to play it by ear when you're in a DC scheme. You don't actually have that much control over your retirement income.
And a similar position, of course, for those with their own pension arrangements, personal pensions or self-invested personal pensions, SIPs, which I suppose just brings home the message that you've really got to keep monitoring these pension arrangements on a very regular basis.
Exactly. You have to monitor pension arrangements, you have to keep an eye on the stock markets, and you have to keep an eye on annuity rates.
So probably a good idea to have a look out for FT Money on the 2nd of January, when we'll be giving the predictions of all of our columnists and various experts. Alice, thank you very much indeed. And if you'd like to know more about the uplift in company pension scheme values and how it could benefit you, look out for Alice's article in this weekend's FT Money with the Weekend FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, a decade of rising, falling and recovering house prices. Can you guess how prices have moved since 2000? We'll give you the answer very shortly. First, though, shareholdings. This week, Capita Registrars, which holds the trading records of 1.6 million UK shareholders in more than 2,000 companies, revealed that private investors are accelerating their sell-off of equities. In October and November, as the stock market rally stalled but prices remained stable, they sold a net £636 million worth of shares, more than triple the amount that they pulled out of the market in August and September. So are they calling time on the bull run and running for cover? Mark, you've examined all of the trading data. Is this a massive sell-off or just profit-taking?
We think this is just profit-taking, Matthew. If we look at how much they sold, £636 million in the context of net buying now of £1 billion for this year, that's even after those sales, £1 billion they've bought this year. And compared to some recent periods of selling, this is really relatively modest. So I think private shareholders who invested quite heavily towards the end of last year and the beginning of this year, taking advantage of low stock market prices, have actually said, well, we've run up nearly 50%. Enough's enough. We'll take a little bit of profit out. But this isn't a wholesale rout. In fact, there's still some trading, some buying and selling going on, so indicating that they're not just pulling money out wholesale.
And if you take the year as a whole, there is this overall net buying over the 12-month period that you've mentioned. But it also seems as if private investors are getting quite savvy in that they bought quite heavily when prices were low, and now they seem to be saying, right, let's book these profits rather than missing out on them.
Yeah, so in time and again, our research seems to show that the old adage that private investors always buy at the top and sell at the bottom doesn't really seem to hold, and they have traded quite cannily. So whether they're right, whether this is a good time to be taking some profit or not, I can't tell you, but they certainly haven't lost out from any major gains in the stock market over the last couple of months. It's been trading sideways, and that does seem to have justified their decision.
But as you say, it's not a mass sell-off, it's not a rout, because that 636 million selling figure is, of course, a net figure. It includes buys that are going on at the same time. Where do you see people still buying?
Well, that's quite interesting. We've had a look at what sorts of shares people are buying, and actually the house builders have come back into fashion after clearly being far out of people's view for some time. The housing market has picked up a little bit. I know we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. House building has also recovered from its pretty disastrous freeze at the end of last year. And the results are starting to come through a little bit more positively from the house builders. So we've seen some buying there. The selling has mainly been, however, in cyclical shares, those shares that are more sensitive to a fall in the overall stock market. So people are being a little bit more defensive. But as we say, this is not a rout by any means.
And this move out of cyclicals, again, I suppose, is more evidence of private investors looking at perhaps arguably valuations, looking at fundamental measures, going into defensive or certainly holding defensives, which of course do offer yield. Is that a factor, do you think?
Well, yield is something that really is very important and quite often overlooked, and something we've done some work on this summer and we'll be looking at again in January, considering how much in dividends the UK is paying out. And you know, the banking sector used to be the big payers. Clearly, they're not paying dividends anymore. In fact, they're still raising vast amounts of capital from their shareholders. And it's the oil companies who've been taking the baton there. But, you know, yield is very important. And, you know, across the board, it's utilities companies, food companies who tend to pay out fairly steady, relatively strong dividends that don't fluctuate a lot depending on market on the condition of the economy.
You mentioned bank shares. Obviously, they're not going to be yielding terribly much for a while. But have private investors run a mile from the whole financial sector, or are they still going into certain companies?
Well, the financial sector has seen a lot of selling over the last 2 to 3 years from private investors. They have tentatively bought a little bit back lately, actually, but it's not really a wholesale move back into the sector. I think we saw earlier this year there was some interest in the likes of Barclays shares, for example, were down right down at the bottom, and when prices were that low, some investors were tempted back into the sector. But it's still a sector which is in some trouble. It's still a sector which is demanding lots of new capital, and as a whole, I think the private investors at least have steered relatively well clear.
And just finally, we're looking back at the decade in FT Money this weekend. This particular sell-off, where does that leave private investors' shareholdings in a historical context?
Well, actually, in a recent historical context, it looks relatively good. Private investors can celebrate the fact that at the end of 2009, their holdings are £31 billion larger than they were at the end of 2008, and that's only after £1 billion of net buying. So most of that is all good news in terms of rising prices. Actually, it's even higher than it was compared to the low point in the market, clearly. But in long-term historical terms, actually, £162 billion is relatively small, and private investors have generally been moving out of equities over the last few years.
Well, I'm going to ignore that and just concentrate on the fact that I'm £31 billion, or a share of £31 billion better off. So, Mark, thanks very much indeed for that. And for the full story of what private investors are selling and still buying, you can read our analysis of stock market trading patterns in FT Money this weekend and on our website at ft.com/money. And finally today, house prices. This week, there was mixed news from the property market. House prices continued to rise during November, according to the latest research from the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. It found that 35% more of its members reported a price increase during the month than those who reported a fall, the highest ratio of rises to falls since November 2006. But while the Halifax House Price Index for November also registered a rise of 1.4%, which was the fifth consecutive monthly increase, the mortgage lender warned that house prices are likely to be flat in 2010. Go back a decade, though, and price rises look very different. So I'm going to just ask a pop quiz question. Mark, over the decade, from 2000, how far do you think house prices have risen on the Halifax House Price Index measure?
Well, I bought my house in 2000, so I'm going to take a stab that it was about 60% since then.
60%. Alice, do you want to hazard a guess?
Oh, that's a tricky question.
It's very tricky.
What, are we talking the average, across the whole country?
The average house price in the UK.
The average house price. I'm going to go with 100%.
100%. Well, not bad, because Tanya, you've been looking at this, and tell us the answer.
It's actually 91%.
Ah.
According to the Halifax House Price Index.
And all of these indices do vary a little.
Yeah, they vary slightly. I mean, I think if you were looking at the nationwide house price index, it'd be more like 116%. So, yes, it does vary. But basically, the average house price in quarter one 2000 would have been around £84,000. That did, in fact, go up to about £199,000 at the peak of the market in August 2007. But obviously, since then, with our kind of, I think we've seen falls of over 20% across the country, it's now fallen back down to £161,000. But it's not too bad if you look at 91% over the past decade.
And when you compare what's happened to house prices with what's happened to other asset classes, residential property is still sort of way ahead, isn't it?
It is. It definitely is. I mean, actually, I think there was some research recently by the property consultants Jones, Lang, LaSalle, and they actually said if you look over the last 10 years, residential property would have delivered about 8% per annum, and that's probably basically outdone the equity markets.
And what do people put this pretty strong rise, in spite of the correction that we've seen in recent years, down to? What are the factors? I suppose the availability of cheap credit would be the first one that springs to mind.
That's one of the main factors. I mean, from what I've been talking to economists about, the last decade overall has seen quite an actually benign economic environment. We've actually had low levels of interest rates, low levels of unemployment, and then we've also had increased competition in the mortgage lending market. So it's just made it a lot more easier for people to actually obtain finance to buy a property. And we've obviously seen the buy-to-let boom, and that's obviously on the back of sort of easy, cheap credit again. So I think those have been the main factors recently, and also the shortage in supply of houses.
Yes, that's true. The supply-demand constraints have certainly been playing a factor recently. But I suppose the $64 million question, or the £84,000 average house price question, is what's the outlook for the next decade? Is there anyone looking that far ahead?
I think it varies quite a bit. A lot of people have been obviously saying next year could be flat, we could see falls. There's some optimists out there who also think actually we'll see some house price rises. But I think overall people are confident that as long as we have sort of kind of a sustainable interest rate, right, like sort of increases, that actually the next decade could still see quite strong growth.
And in the short term, there are some estate agents, I think Cluttons came out this week and said that they thought that more properties might come onto the market in 2010 when people look at these rises in the Halifax and Nationwide house price indices and think, oh, I can finally offload my property. And then the supply-demand factor comes in, we get an oversupply, and there's a double dip. Do you think that there's that much danger of prices falling again?
I think there's a possibility. I think it all depends also with what happens with the mortgage lending market. I think if people are able to actually obtain a mortgage, if the criteria eases a bit more next year, there could be a possibility actually that, you know, house prices won't fall that much, because even though there's more properties on the market, there'll be people out there still wanting to buy a home, be able to sort of kind of move on the ladder. I mean, it's really the first time buyers is an important factor in this next year. I think if they're able to either come up with a deposit or actually obtain the financing, then there might not be that many kind of, you know, worries.
That's the tragedy for them, isn't it? Because the prices have been so low and more affordable for them last year or so than at any time in the last few years, and they haven't been able to get the mortgages to actually get on the ladder.
Well, that's the problem.
Exactly. So much will depend in 2010 and indeed the next decade on the mortgage lenders, as ever. Tania, thank you very much indeed for that. And if you'd like to know how house prices and indeed ISAs, equity and bond funds and pensions have fared since the millennium, then look out for the four-page special review of the decade in FT Money this weekend. But that's all for this week's FT Money show, and that's all for 2009 as well. Remember, you can get weekday news updates on our website ft.com/money, and you can read and comment on our latest blog posts at ft.com/moneymatters. We'll be back on January the 8th, 2010, with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye and a very happy Christmas and New Year from me, Alice, Tania, and our special studio guest, Mark Baker from Capital Registrars.
Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.